The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those challenging a prevailing wisdom in financial markets. I'm your host, Nathaniel E. Baker. On today's podcast, we are talking about leverage. Now, if you hear the word leverage, typically your initial reaction is a negative one. Leverage, or leverage, as our friends on the other side of the Atlantic call it, is typically associated with greater risk and more danger. But what if our ideas about leverage are, if not wrong, then at least significantly short-sighted? And what if leverage actually, or I should say the proper use of leverage, actually can contain many answers that are vexing investors at present? Our guest, David Kreintzes of ETF Portfolio Management, makes this very point. Now, David has a theory that he's tested over the last two decades that can produce superior risk-adjusted returns in just about any market. And leverage is the key to the whole thing, or one of them. My conversation with David, which took place last week, as I record this on Monday, May 20th, 2019, also touched on several other subjects. We talk a lot about AI, artificial intelligence, what that all might mean for investors, for markets, for society, for the economy. But before I roll the tape on this, a reminder that nothing we say should be viewed or taken as investment advice. Everything on this podcast is intended as information only. With that, let's roll the tape and get to it. Here you go. Enjoy. Tell me why my ideas of leverage are wrong. Because when I think of leverage, I think of LTCM, I think of Lehman Brothers, I think of some hedge fund with borrowed money from his prime broker that's doing all kinds of crazy stuff with illiquid securities and you know, trying to juice returns and all these other things. But you actually have a way where retail investors can benefit. But let's go back. Why are my ideas about leverage wrong?
Well, the ideas most investors have about leverage aren't necessarily wrong as much as there's been a lot of change on Wall Street in terms of the instruments that are available to access leverage. And because of the new instruments, investors are now able to access leverage in a safer way than they were in the past. So it's not that leverage isn't dangerous, it's just that the new tools make it more feasible than it has been.
So it's different this time?
It's different in the sense that we've seen how treasuries, long-term treasuries, have performed in recent crashes, and that's really given investors a greater level of confidence that treasuries can be a shock absorber to growth assets, which allows for the use of leverage in a moderate manner. But at the end of the day, investors have to have a mechanism to turn leverage off, because in a black swan event, in something extremely unexpected, you could certainly have an environment where equities and long-term treasuries go down together significantly. So if material leverage is being used, additional risk controls are certainly warranted.
Right. Now, tell me about your strategy, because you invest pretty much exclusively through leveraged ETFs. Is that right?
For the most part, we do access individual stocks when it's appropriate. With the use of leveraged sector indexes and asset class indexes, the attractiveness of company-specific risk is lessened greatly. So many investors have learned the merits of indexing over the years, and the advent of levered ETFs just makes an even greater case for sticking with more diversified products than individual securities. However, on occasion, you do have your standout companies, whether it's an Nvidia or a Twilio or more recently a Roku. There are standout trends in individual stocks that we certainly participate in. But for the most part, levered ETFs have raised the bar significantly to justify company-specific risk.
So how would one put together a portfolio of levered ETFs?
Well, at the website investablebenchmarks.com, we show samples where we start from the traditional unlevered solution for income and growth, and then we show samples for 2x and 3x, and we have a fourth version that's the aggressive growth version for income and tech 3x. And the simple concept for all of them is that half of the portfolio is long-term treasuries. And the discipline in sticking with long-term treasuries for the entire bond portion is predicated on the reality that when there's a crash in equities, the flood of money coming out of equities does not have many doors to go into that are big enough for that flood. And long-term treasuries are a well-accepted shock absorber for turbulence in equities. So when you stick to long-term treasuries on the bond side, it's very efficient to allow you to have that equity exposure for the other half of the portfolio, especially when leverage is engaged. And when leverage is engaged with a technology focus, the additional risk controls become exceedingly important.
Did I get this right? Every portfolio, no matter what its risk profile, is 50% in treasuries, long-term treasuries?
Correct. In the passive investable benchmarks, when we employ these products in our active absolute return strategies, that's not necessarily the case. Our tactical 3x portfolio is a risk parity focused solution. So that does target to maintain that half long-term treasuries. But the other absolute return strategies are not mandated to have the long-term treasury component.
Is there no concern that one day this whole treasury safe haven thing just no longer holds true?
Yeah, there's tremendous concern. And I think it's been lessened by the Fed's commentary lately, but all things considered, experienced investors know it's critical to expect the unexpected. So just because we haven't seen anything something before doesn't mean it can't happen. And even if we've seen it happen, doesn't mean it can't happen more often. And correlations simply work until they stop. So we're always prepared to take the leverage off the table quickly if needed. And that added risk control discipline is what makes the passive implementation more feasible.
What makes you decide how to allocate risk and where to allocate? Like, what kinds of signals do you look for? Are these macroeconomic variables? You mentioned risk parity. What goes into your decisions there?
So from a risk perspective, we're constantly monitoring all the major asset classes and recognizing that their price action is the culmination of all the available information in the market, much of which we don't have. So it's counterintuitive to feel that the headlines in the market are irrelevant, the news is irrelevant. But if we react to the news or whatever headlines we're aware of, that's a thimble of information relative to the price action in the market. So what we react to as trend followers is the price action of the market. And ultimately, price is truth. It doesn't really matter if you think something's overvalued or undervalued. If that's where it's trading, that's where your portfolio is marked. So we have to recognize that in an uptrend, we have to have triggers that force us to get invested. And in a downtrend, our triggers have to force us to get out. And the key is to make that process as efficient as possible.
Where are we right now in the markets in terms of this up or downtrend?
Where we are right now is kind of on a borderline between risk on and risk off. We're kind of right in the neighborhood where you're close enough to new highs that you have risk of continued upside in investors' fear of missing out and needing to chase performance. And at the same time, you have these huge gains on the table this year that investors are inclined to want to take given the seasonality and given what we saw last year and the rhetoric around the trade war. So there's a lot of swirling currents as usual.
Now, you mentioned these variables, and as I'm sure you know, there's a certain commander in chief who likes to use a certain thing called Twitter. And you know, whatever your political beliefs, he can very quickly and has very quickly moved markets. How does one account for that? Like, we had that famous event. I mean, over the last couple of weeks now, just with China, not just with China. There have been several times where the tweets from a certain @RealDonaldTrump have caused massive swings in markets worldwide. How do you account for that in your model?
Or do tweet, tweet risk might be a new term on Wall Street, but at the end of the day, investors have to recognize that the price action in the market can be driven by a large number of factors. And if the president's tweet is the last straw that ignites the move, it's not the only straw in the equation, right? There's a lot of other factors at work there. So if the market is poised to barrel higher, and if the underpinnings of the global economy support higher asset prices, then that rhetoric might push and pull things here and there. But the overall strength of the trend should be dictated by much more concrete material factors in the economy. So I don't really think that the tweet influence is something that investors should be distracted by. It's really the price action is going to be driven by far more factors than just a tweet.
Cool. Okay, I want to drill down a little bit and ask you some more specific questions, especially when it comes to the single stock securities, if you don't mind after. But let's first take a quick break. You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. We are on the social media. Our Twitter handle is @PodContrarian. We could certainly use the followers. Are lagging behind a certain president quite significantly. So please do follow. I also have a LinkedIn page, Contrarian Podcast, and on Instagram as well, which I'm starting to figure out. But that's another story for another day. David, tell us a little bit about you. You mentioned your website previously. Tell us about your firm and where we can find you.
Sure. So our firm is ETF Portfolio Management. Our websites are etfpm.com and investablebenchmarks.com. And the firm was really launched with a passion for research and innovation. So we quickly created the investable benchmarks to show investors sample core portfolios for the four main investor risk profiles, income and growth, growth and aggressive growth, which investors can think of as small, medium, large, and extra large in terms of risk and return objectives. And our expertise during the internet crash and again during the liquidity crisis in 2008 really enhanced our trend following expertise. And since the 2008 crash, we've demonstrated a very strong capacity to deliver gains in a crash and to maintain those gains. So the algorithm that we created in the internet crash has been refined and enhanced and delivered gains in the crash of 08, protected investors again in the flash crash of 2010, and significantly outperformed and delivered gains last year in the bear market of 2018. So we're very excited to show investors this next generation Vanguard Bridgewater platform. And we're really showing investors that you can access leading absolute return strategies using ultra low cost ETFs. And they can be provided in a robo-advisor structure, a separate account structure with an active advisory fee, as well as a hedge fund structure.
Right. Really interesting. And you touched on it. You have a long history on Wall Street and investing. And going back to the internet crash you referred to, which for our younger listeners took place last century, actually. Actually, no, I'm sorry. It started in 1999 was the height of the bubble. And then the bust happened in 2000 and 2001. But tell me a little bit about that and the lessons that you learned from that and how that caused you to tweak your portfolio, which then was successful in navigating 2008 and 2009.
Sure. When I was managing the trend following portfolio we engaged in 2000, we didn't even know that we were trend following. We didn't even know what trend following was. Mm-hmm. We simply knew that we needed an algorithmic approach. And as the internet bubble peaked and crashed, we became aware of the commodity trading advisor universe and the trend following industry. And we realized that a completely rules-based process would have navigated the internet crash perfectly. And it took us time to modify the last piece of the puzzle, the piece that really protects the gains in a crash, that helps you stay out of the really choppy volatility that burns investors up. And getting our algorithm to the point where it could navigate the crash of 08 and last year really was an incredibly difficult process. I like to say that it was like counting the blades of grass at a baseball stadium. It was incredibly tedious, extremely frustrating. I wanted to quit many, many times. But ultimately, we were fortunate enough to study the world's leading portfolio managers. And we found some information, some tidbits of quotes that really were the key to the lock that enabled us to enhance the algorithm to the point where it could navigate the toughest volatility. And once we saw how efficiently it worked in the crash of 08, we were very excited to scale that solution. And then from 2008 to 2015, all the central bank stimulus and efforts in that regard turbocharged indexing. So most active strategies, you know, the hedge fund industry as a whole has had a very difficult time keeping up with strategic indexing in that past decade. When we got to 2015, we saw that these levered ETFs had enough actual data. They were exceeding the three-year age level. And we saw that there was enough data to start analyzing how they work, when they don't work. And we were always mindful of the fact that Bridgewater had this all-weather portfolio that seemed a little too simple for a hedge fund fee structure, levered diversification. And we looked at the efficiency and low risk of a disciplined income and growth portfolio, and the light bulb went off that, you know, how would that look if we put leverage on the safest portfolio we could construct? And once we saw how strong the math was, we started applying those tools to the active management. And once we engaged leverage with discipline, the performance enhancement was so material that we quickly shifted gears to launch a hedge fund with our active Max Alpha solution, in addition to pursuing ETFs of ETFs for the investable benchmarks. But investors in general are still warming up to leverage. They're still warming up to levered ETFs. But we try to highlight the logic in that Americans today use a lot of leverage to buy their homes, and they buy their cars with debt and financing. But their retirement nest eggs that are multi-generational in many respects for many folks, they use zero leverage. And it turns out that that was only because the toolbox was inefficient. The margin account couldn't be used for a retirement account where you have the tax advantage. And the margin account gave you a small amount of leverage, up to 50%. And you'd have a margin call if your account went against you. Now with the levered ETFs, the leverage is in the ETF. So there's no margin call. You could use them in a retirement account. You typically want to be careful not to use the same levered ETFs trading in a retirement account as a taxable account because of the wash sale, the disallowed wash sales in that scenario that people can be surprised by. Investors have also created a lot of backlash about the levered ETFs not working perfectly because they don't give you the exact multiple of the underlying index every year. Right. But when you look at how they work and when they work, you realize they work well enough. They were just named wrong. They should have been target two times, target three times. But when you're in a trend environment that is meaningful, meaning the underlying index is up or down more than 10%, you have less deviation from your expectation. You get closer to your target multiple. When you get a choppy sideways year where you're plus or minus 10%, that's where the breakdown gets to be the most surprising. But when they're used properly in a balanced approach with additional risk controls, the up environments more than compensate you for the disappointing environments, at least most recently. And the only comfort the investor can really have is that there's a bus driver who's willing to pull over when it's too dangerous. So we serve as that service. Mm-hmm. But the value enhancement is very logical. When you think of Harry Markowitz and his teachings that diversification can be a free lunch, it's mind-blowing when you recognize how valuable it is to see strategic lever diversification amplify trailing returns by a magnitude of 3 to 10 times or more, giving the investor the potential to generate a free retirement nest egg when done properly.
Mm. And then when done properly, I mean, a lot of this depends on getting the direction right, obviously, because while you can get huge returns with leverage, you can also get crushed pretty quickly as well. And so you have to, I guess, to your original point, have some pretty serious risk controls, right?
Absolutely. The discipline to turn off leverage and to turn it back on is not something that the individual should engage recklessly. It's certainly a recipe for disaster.
Right.
But if they tiptoe and if they reward success and if they search for professional providers who have expertise in the toughest markets, they can access leverage with discipline and they can enhance traditional indexing performance significantly.
Interesting. Okay. Now, you had mentioned to me before, not on this conversation, how you the semiconductor index, how these can be a pretty good proxy just for growth in general. Talk to me about that a little bit and why you like those.
Well, the semiconductor trend has been the blowout trend of the past 5 to 10 years. And when investors look at what Amazon just did to the mall and all the robots that you saw on the Super Bowl commercials, you have to recognize that the robots are coming everywhere and they don't need houses. Mm-hmm. They don't need office space. When you look at Twilio and you look at their voice automation communications for companies, you have to shudder to think at all the customer service, you know, desks that are going to go empty when companies realize that they can save a tremendous amount of money having AI do their customer service. So our expectation is that real estate of all types, with the exception of maybe data centers and maybe multifamily, have material secular headwinds because of this advent of AI and more advanced automation. Where that wealth is going to transfer is to semiconductors and to technology, which are replacing the worker, and they're also replacing energy. When you look at solar and battery, that whole matrix of solution is another example of technology taking the place of other asset classes like energy, your traditional oil and gas. So technology we've seen ramp up to be a much higher percentage in the S&P 500, and it's still a fraction of the peak sectors when real estate and energy were peaks. So as much as technology is increasing in its weighting, it's still a fraction of the peak weighting that we've seen in other asset classes. And it's really a most exciting time when investors recognize that the internet bubble was one of the greatest wealth creation opportunities of our generation. And the internet bubble was built on the fact that companies can connect online and have this connectivity and do commerce, and that's wonderful. But the advent of AI is an exponentially greater utility than just an internet connection, right? Just e-commerce. When you replace a worker with a machine that's fully paid off in a fraction of the time that you pay a worker an annual salary in many cases, and the machine is expected to be incredibly smarter than the human in a relatively short order. When you listen to Miyoshi-san from SoftBank, and he talks about the expectation that AI is going to reach 30,000 IQ points, and it could be decades away, but if Mensa considers a genius at 130, and you're expecting AI to dwarf that in relatively soon time, how long are investors going to wait to recognize that semiconductors are the key to the competitiveness of every government in their military, every business in their operations, and every individual in their job security? So the individual's best defense against the matrix and against automation taking their jobs is owning the matrix, and that's owning semiconductors. So when you look at what the semiconductor index has done for the past decade, it's compounded it well above the S&P, above the NASDAQ 100, and the 3x version, Soxel, S-O-X-L, has been an extraordinary instrument. It broke 100% in 2017. It had a rough year last year. Twilio is one that we blogged about earlier this year that we consider a phenomenal long-term buy and hold for investors that don't want active trading. They are at the forefront of automating communications for companies. So if you call up an Uber, or I'm not sure if they're working with Uber, Lyft, or both, but you'll get your car communications about your car through their automated service. Mm-hmm. They've done some phenomenal work with the Red Cross. And when you realize what a game changer it is to have your customer communications automated and eventually much smarter than a human, that's a runway for incredible growth. And then aside from Twilio and Roku, another name that's rare for us to mention because it's an IPO, investors who recently saw the Beyond Meat IPO, that's a trend that really appears to be in its infancy. Beyond Meat had a shocking IPO.
Yeah.
Their stock opened up significantly higher than it priced. It peaked over 200% above its IPO price. It's been the strongest IPO of the year so far. One analogy we'd like to give is, imagine your retirement nest egg is a motorboat, right? And the distance the motorboat goes is your return over time. You could have one big engine, your one single growth portfolio, super powerful, but it can blow up. If it blows up, you're in trouble, and it can blow up. Or you can have three smaller engines, much lower blow-up risk, almost no blow-up risk, but you could have three of them. The collective power of the three engines is bigger than the power of the one big engine, and the collective blow-up risk of those three engines is lower. And that's what we've seen in the math of these investable benchmarks. So when investors realize that levered risk parity or levered income and growth is a superior approach to unlevered solutions, you're going to see a massive transformation on Wall Street across the board. Just like you saw Apple come out of nowhere and dominate the smartphone industry, because the whole paradigm changed from the flip phone to the smartphone, Wall Street has been overdue for that transition. And that transition is from unlevered solutions to levered solutions. And the math is overwhelmingly clear. Just ask Ray Dalio.
Mm-hmm. All right. Very good. All right. Well, we touched on a lot of stuff, and I think you certainly make the point very clear for levered solutions of various kinds. You've been listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and all the others. David, remind us once again where we can find you before we sign off.
Sure. Thanks, Nathaniel. We're at ETF Portfolio Management, and you can find us online at etfpm.com and investablebenchmarks.com. And thank you for having us.
Thanks for joining. And with that, we will close and look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.